I know with a lot of the early AFL footage, I mean, it's funny because we talk about All 22 and pretty much all they had was All 22. They couldn't afford anything but coaches' film. The All 22 you were able to get for the older games, like the 63 AFL Championship, did that take time to unearth what you wanted? And were you limited in the technology when you were analyzing the older games?
No, we weren't able to get what we wanted, and that made it, in a sense, somewhat similar to what we do on a daily basis. And what also helped us was we were able to get the network telecast of those games as well, and that really helped even more. Because, as you know, when you're listening to an announcer and they've just spent 2 or 3 days with a team, you even increase your knowledge of backstory because they give you information from their conversations with coaches leading up to their game broadcast.
A specific example maybe of something that enlightened you from those broadcasts?
You know, nothing that I can specifically remember, but for instance, I watched the game telecast of the Bears-Cowboys game in 85 that we did, and it was John Madden and Pat Summerall doing that game. So while I can't specifically remember, a pearl of wisdom from Madden, I made notes of the 5 or 6 things he said that clearly came from either his study of the Bears or probably from conversations with Mike Ditka and Buddy Ryan, and that just enhanced. What it does very often is you hear something and you go, oh, okay, and then you look at something a different way because you have a greater knowledge base.
So in overall sense, these chapters were gleaned from a mix of All 22 and the broadcast, and that really brought it into a sharper focus overall.
Well, and also from conversations I probably interviewed personally over the phone or in person, anywhere from 50 to 75 people.
Wow.
So, then you learn a lot as well. And as you know, when people are removed from the game and not still active, they tend to be much more open and honest about how they did things back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start with the Gilman chapter. We know that he was the father of the modern passing game, and he's frequently given credit as the mind behind the vertical offense. But I've heard different takes on how much his idea of spacing routes, positioning routes, had to do with the West Coast offense. What is your take on that?
The reason that stuff's hard to answer with it specifically is because I think one of the things we learned in doing this, and I think you spoke about reading Tim Layden's book, is there's so much that people take from other people, and you never can say, well, this is something they exactly took from this guy. You just don't know that kind of thing. I mean, and it's funny because the way this book came about, Doug, is I sit and watch tape every single week, and you see the game change, not on an annual basis or in 5-year increments, but often you see things on a weekly basis. And it just makes you think, okay, where did this initially start? And then, how do people then take stuff that's been used and sort of make it their own? So it starts the process. I mean, I don't think Don Coryell or Bill Walsh, and we know that Bill Walsh really started with this concept back in 69, not with the 49ers. I think that, people, first of all, necessity ends up being the mother of a lot of this invention, as was the case with Walsh. And I think people just have ideas that they throw out there and they see if they work. My guess is that there's a lot of ideas that were thrown out there that didn't work, and then we didn't hear a lot about them, and then maybe someone else came back and used them, 20 years later. I don't think you can separate a lot of these ideas and from one another. I think in many ways they all overlap.
Mm-hmm. In the blow-by-blow of the 63 championship, you both mentioned how the Chargers were able to get things going so well on the ground, obviously at Lincoln Low backfield, what Buffalo was doing. Do you think the AFL in general was underrated when it came to power running?
You mean the entire AFL?
Just the AFL in general. Because the caricature of the league in a general sense is flinging the ball all the time.
Well, that's what made this game particularly interesting, because even though Sid Gilman's contribution overall has to do with his passing game principles, this game was fascinating, and obviously it was a game that had to be done because you just don't see 610 yards of total offense in any professional game. Even back in the old AFL days, it was that there was so much running in this game. they weren't really power runs in this given game. They were traps and draws and tosses. They were runs to take advantage of a team that blitzed and that worked off pass game principles as opposed to lining up and saying, here we are, stop us with a run game.
Mm-hmm. So this was basically Sid's checkmate. You expect us to pass, you're going to play the pass, and now we're going to run.
Right, and then the thing to remember, which I'm sure, I can't remember everything, every page in the book, obviously, but during that season, those teams played twice. And actually, the Patriots had done a really good job against the Chargers offense in those two games with their blitzes. And Gilman was trying to figure out a way to attack that high pressure concept, because not many other teams in the AFL did that, if any, as I recall, and he had to find a way to attack and break down that Patriots defense, and obviously this was his game plan, and it worked to perfection.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they scored touchdowns on something like four of the first 10 plays, I think, gained like over 200 yards. I mean, it was a ridiculous number.
That is fairly ridiculous.
I mean, again, I might not have been exactly right in my math, but I do know that it's something like that.
Moving to Bud Carson, how specifically did he change coverage concepts?
Well, I would say he dramatically changed coverage concepts because no one played anything like cover two prior to that point. It was man-to-man, and it was... If it was a zone, it was single high safety, kind of cover three, which was still essentially man on the outside. So he dramatically changed coverage concepts in the NFL.
And then you mentioned the stunt 4-3 is something that Joe Green used to devastating effect, and I remember it from the, I think it was 74 Steelers America's game. Do you see teams using this today? I mean, I had written something about maybe Ndamukong Suh should use it, do the rules allow it, and do you see it a lot now?
Well, you don't see it in that specific form, but again, now it's the advanced concept, because what teams do is now the same concept is putting a quote-unquote D-tackle/nose tackle in the gap between the guard and the center. See, the whole point of that nose was to make sure that two offensive linemen had to account for him. That's the point. You can line up and stand on your head. It doesn't matter how you actually do it. The point is you want to make sure that two offensive linemen have to account for that player. That's the point.
Mm-hmm. And Monty Kiffin has said in recent years that the Tampa 2 became a lot better when we had better players, quote-unquote. The Steelers of that area obviously had the talent to make it go. Do you find that there are inherent weaknesses in the base formation that other teams fall prey to because they don't have that specific talent?
Yeah, in fact, I believe strongly, this is my personal opinion now, I'm not speaking for anybody else, I think cover two is a very easy defense to tactically exploit in the pass game. There's too many holes. So the key to it becomes pass rush, and obviously we know what the Steelers' D-line was, and we know at times other teams that have played it well have had really good pass, consistent pass rushes. But if you don't get consistent pressure from a down four, it's a very beatable defense. And that's why that defense has evolved over time, too. I mean, a lot of teams play that more as a matchup zone kind of defense. Tony Dungy was a big believer in having guys drop to a landmark, to a spot, and not necessarily reading routes. Now a lot of Tampa 2 has evolved so that you read routes and you match up in your area. Because, otherwise it's too easy to break down.
Yeah.
And it also, the whole concept of that too, Doug, is you're trying to make the other team be patient, and even if they're going to complete balls for 5 or 6 yards, fine, you tackle them, and you make them take 12, 13, 14 plays to move the ball down the field, and that's tough to do in today's NFL.
Right. But you're juggling a lot of chainsaws there.
What's that?
You're kind of juggling all that chainsaws there defensively, because that one big play can really knock you out.
Right, right. And the whole point is you don't give up the big play in Tampa 2. That's the point.
Yeah.
But, again, the Steelers, first of all, they see, most of this is, as you know, in this book, is a combination of a great idea working with the right talent. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to have the right talent, obviously. And I think that that's what the Steelers had. They, Carson came in with an approach. And actually, as we said in the book, that approach is really designed to stop the college option, because what Tampa 2 does is it puts both corners on the line of scrimmage, so they become run-front defenders. So to stop the college option, you basically are playing with 9 run-front defenders. But then it turned out to work exceptionally well in a league at the time in which you were allowed to just maul receivers coming off the line. So, you know, now you have Mel Blount, 6'3", 220, and you have the other corner, I'm losing his name, it's escaping me at the moment. They were big, it might have been Edwards, they were big guys.
JT Thomas?
So they, what's that?
JT Thomas?
Maybe JT Thomas, right. I think Edwards was the safety.
Yeah.
And he was a big guy, too. You know, so you could maul receivers and disrupt routes, you know, which then helps the pass rush. And then you get Jack Lambert in 74. And, you know, obviously Jack Lambert is, he was a special athlete. I mean, he got probably played at 205 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, he could run like a safety. And as we talk about in the book, which everybody talked about, they all talked about him being 6'4", and how important that was, because you could not throw it over him.
Right. And moving to the Coryell chapter, where we then talk about the Mel Blount rule, you bring that up, and you mentioned how he used the liberalized passing rules to take Gilman's concepts further. How specifically did he do that?
Based on timing, and receivers could not be disrupted at the line of scrimmage. See, if receivers are disrupted, the timing's done, and that's where the rules impacted Coryell, because Coryell was the first guy to have the quarterback throw the ball before receivers came out of breaks. What we call timing and anticipation today. You know, that's what people mean by anticipation, and now that's a part of every NFL pass game, and in fact, that's something you look for when you look at NFL quarterbacks projecting and transitioning to the NFL. Can they throw with anticipation? Can they throw before receivers come out of breaks? We take that for granted now. Coryell was the first guy to install that and do it, and the liberalized rules helped that happen.
How common, I mean, he took was he the father of the three-digit system, or where that, I know it's very prevalent today.
In the book, we talk about that. And sorry, I'm eating something. He started that at San Diego State when they played with a ton of transfers. And he would, back then, the rules were so liberalized that he could get a kid in on Wednesday and he could play on Saturday. So he needed to come up with a way to teach, you know, get a receiver out there on Saturday when he came in on Wednesday. So he simply named routes by numbers. So, you know, and then that's a three-digit system. So you come in, you want them to run three routes. You want them to run a go route, so it's a 9. You want them to run a deep post, it's an 8. You want them to run a dig, it's a 6. Boom. Those are the three routes you're going to run this week. A 6, an 8, and a 9. Pretty easy to remember that.
Right.
So that's how it all started.
Is that maybe the best way to put across complex, like the Al Saunders playbook of 700 pages, but you got the vertical system? Is that the best way to mesh it up?
Yep. No question. And, you know, then you can do a ton of things. Look, we know with playbooks you can do a zillion things, but at the end of the day, it's so much easier to go in the huddle and say, okay, we're going to run a 989, you know, 2 goes and a deep post, and everybody knows what that means instead of seeing what each one of those things is. See, the West Coast is more words. You say what the routes are that you know, I'm sure you've seen when we've wired John Gruden when he was a coach and you hear those play calls.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the quarterback's reciting a dictionary.
Yep. Moving to a Gruden, you know, a Gruden master was Walsh. How different do you think his offensive concepts would have been if Greg Cook had stayed healthy?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, because we may never have gotten to the West Coast offense, because many people believe that Greg Cook was as gifted a passer, a deep passer, as ever played. You know, I mean, you know, at the level of the great ones, you know, that have come on since. So, and don't forget, Walsh was initially schooled in the Sid Gilman, Al Davis deep passing game. That was his early learning process. So, as we made clear in the book, and I was fortunate enough to know Bill and have this conversation with him numerous times personally, is is, this was all, you know, as I said, necessity is the mother of invention. He was on an expansion team with a bad O-line. They couldn't run the ball. He just was looking for a way to make first downs. You know, I mean, that's all he was trying to do. He just wanted to make first downs. And this is what, you know, he came up with, and it obviously became brilliant.
Yeah. Is the West Coast offense phasing out now, or are the concepts just so ubiquitous at this point that the system has become more the threat of the game?
I think it's more the methodology, Doug, of how it's taught, more than the exact, you know, certainly they have a lot of those principles, I mean, you know, but I think pass games, that was my point when we started, I think a lot of this stuff overlaps now, but it's the way a lot of this stuff's taught. It's the methodology of teaching it. You know, how do you teach the quarterback? How do you teach the receivers? That's more of what it is. And, you know, I think every offense in the NFL, for the most part, has principles and route combinations that you would call West Coast and you would call Coryell-based. You know, you just have to. You know, you're trying to, that's the evolution of the game. You're always trying to expand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Andy Reid was a quote-unquote West Coast disciple. You watch the Eagles the last couple of years under McNabb, and they had clearly morphed away from the so-called West Coast, you know, shallow crosses underneath routes to throwing the ball down the field more, because that's what McNabb did best, and that's what the receivers did best.
Yeah, and they drafted around that. They drafted deep combo receivers. And
right, right. So, I mean, if they still have all those principles, and that's probably the way it's taught. But, you know, you just combine principles.
Yeah. Moving to the 46, and let me know along here. I mean, I have a list of questions. If you're pressed for time, let me know, and I can kind of condense this.
I can go about it. I can go till 10, and then I got to move
okay.
on.
Yeah. 46 seems like a defense where very specific personnel is needed. At least that's just my impression. Can teams run 46 looks as an adjunct to the other things they do? And the second question there is it a better fit for 3-4 or 4-3 personnel?
It's a 4-3 defense because essentially what you're doing is it all starts with what we call a bare front, where you have three defensive linemen who cover the three interior offensive linemen, and then you have a pass rusher who's lined up wide in what we call a wide nine. So it's a 4-3 defense. And what you're trying to create is one-on-one matchups on the inside, because if you line up three defensive linemen head up on the center and the two guards, they have to block them one-on-one because they're right in front of them. And then you line up a defensive end, Richard Dent, who most people believe was the key player on that defense. You line him up on the weak side, wide, you know, over an offensive tackle. And the offensive tackle then is forced to block him one-on-one, and less than you want to help with a back, or, you know, and then you've won almost to start because you're taking eligible receivers out of the mix.
What does Rex do that Buddy didn't?
Oh, Rex's principles are much more 3-4 based. There's more moving parts. See, at the end of the day, the 46 had four down linemen. They're stationary. They're static. You know, any 3-4 based defense has more moving parts.
Well, moving to moving parts, we move to Dick LeBeau, who's probably the master of the moving parts.
And that's exactly right. LeBeau would be the first guy to tell you that the zone blitz concept works much better and really is built for a 3-4 because of the moving parts, more stand-up players. The more stand-up players you have, the more moving parts you have. Because if you have four guys down with their hand on the ground, they're static. They may be great players, that's not the point, but they're static. They're not moving before the snap of the ball.
Right. And talking about LeBeau, but I saw allusions in your book and other places. I think it was Larry Eisenhower, you specifically mentioned the 63 game, that ran his own blitz.
I was amazed to see that. Yeah, I was amazed. There were two plays that had those principles.
And you had talked about, and this is a common theme again, of it kind of comes from everywhere and somebody puts it through the funnel and stamps his name on it. How did LeBeau put it all together beyond what it was when he took ownership of it?
Well, the other coach who used a lot of those principles was Bill Armsbarger, and he's sort of LeBeau's godfather when it comes to the zone blitz. LeBeau took took it and ran with it. But Arnsberger used a lot of it with Miami and the, you know, the Killer Bees, and because he had those kinds of players. You know, he had an A.J. Dewey, a guy who was a precursor to the guy who could put his hand on the ground and stand up. You know, players like that. You need certain kind of players, obviously. But for LeBeau, it was really a reaction to trying to defend passing games. Defense always ends up being a response to offense. And what you had is now LeBeau had to defend Coryell, Walsh, the run and shoot, because it was in his division. So he had to find a way in his mind to pressure the quarterback without compromising coverage. See, prior to that, all blitzes were basically zero blitzes. You know, you rushed and you played man-to-man all over the field. And if you get beat that way, you get beat for touchdowns. LeBeau's, his whole concept, if you reduce it to simplest terms, was safe pressure. How could I still rush the quarterback without sacrificing coverage?
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole genesis of his concept.
Moving to the final chapter, Belichick and the way you talked about his defense in the Super Bowl. But, I mean, I talked to Lawyer Malloy a little bit about that last week because I happened to be up in Seattle. And he mentioned in a general sense the adjustments that the Rams made to get back in that game. But I was more interested in your thoughts about, because there are so many hybrid defenses. There are so many 3-4/4-3 defenses. And I'm wondering if Belichick is the father of that.
That's a great question. I mean, to be honest, I couldn't answer that with any certainty because, you know, I think you see so many coaches, you know, and I see it now. Obviously, this is after, you know, Belichick, but, you know, so many coaches jump back and forth with different principles. You know, a perfect example is the Cowboys of today. They're not a 3-4. Even though they technically line up in that personnel, the whole concept of that defense is 4-3. They just have, you know, it's just that DeMarcus Ware and Anthony Spencer stand up, but it's a 4-3 defense. So, you know, a lot of the principles, you know, it's based on concepts and principles, not on whether a guy has his, you know, hand on the ground in a 3-point stance or standing up in a 2-point stance. It's the concept of the defense.
Right. I'm referring specifically, actually, to about a number of years before that when he had that chess piece in Lawrence Taylor and started moving around and that hybrid.
That was
generally one guy who can kind of line up everywhere.
See, that was that's the same defense as the Cowboys. That's four. Lawrence Taylor. That was a 4-3. He stood up, so people said it was a 3-4. But again, same concept. That was a 4-3 under defense. You wanted Lawrence Taylor on the open side. Just like the Cowboys always put DeMarcus Ware on the open side. He's not a right outside linebacker or a left outside linebacker. He lines up on the open side. He's basically a wide 4-3 D end. He just doesn't put his hand on the ground. That's what Lawrence Taylor was.
Mm-hmm. How have you seen Belichick's defensive concepts change in the decades since that first Super Bowl win?
Because you have to react to offense. And I think, you know, now you have to deal with a lot more three wide, with a lot more spread concepts. You get a lot more one back. One back, see, pressure concepts very often work off of who's in the backfield, whether it's one back or two back. That's the way teams structure their pressure concepts. And you get a lot more one back. Now, obviously, the Rams were a lot of one back because they were three wide. But you have a ton more one back. Although, it's funny, it's kind of going back to the future a little bit. You're seeing a lot more two back today. And I think that's not so much for the run game. And again, this is my personal opinion. I think it's more for protection purposes because you do not have overload concepts with two back.
Right. And going to the future chapter, what do you believe to be the most important and far-reaching schematic trend now? If you come back a decade from now, and I'd love for you guys to do this, and wrote a chapter 8, what do you think it would be?
Well, now I can only give you my opinion, not Ron Jaworski's opinion, because, you know, I personally think you're going to see offensive linemen get smaller and faster. Because there's too many pressure schemes that involve the second and third level players who are so quick and so fast, and three 330-pound guys just can't do it. They can't do it. They can't block these guys. You know, and it's funny. We went through all of Jay Cutler's sacks this week. Eight of his 23 sacks, someone came in clean. And on all eight, it was either a linebacker or a defensive back. In fact, six of the eight were defensive backs. This is what teams do now. You know, their concepts involve defensive backs as blitzers. And this has been evolving that way over the last number of years. And, you know, the Leonard Davis offensive lineman in the world can't play in this league now. And that's why Davis gets benched last week. And he can't, you know, he can't pass protect. Guys like, and I'm just using him as an example, guys like that can't pass protect because they can't react to linebackers and safeties and cornerbacks.
So if you were to do that Chapter 8, you know, 5 or 10 years from now, would Alex Gibbs be the sort of the schematic father of that idea, or who would be it?
Yeah, probably, because I think the run games at that point, you know, are going to have to work more off synchronized execution because the size of the linemen would be smaller, you know, less power, less where you're trying to just physically manhandle people. You're going to have to beat them more with a synchronized execution and dancing bears as opposed to just mauling people.
Yeah. Okay, Greg, that's awesome. It's great stuff. Once again, you've exceeded my expectations.